If the last time you were thirsty, you went to a well and the water made you sick, are you gonna go back to that specific well expecting it to be safe?
Simeon, Alvin, along came John, talking about movies as their only job. So wouldn't the pod about movies be fun? For all you know, this is the only one.
We'll be part of 30% podcast, where we discuss all things movies, past, present, and occasionally future. My name is Sammy Chester, and today we are chatting new movies from not only June, also May, and in fact April. So this is only the second so-called monthly episode we've made this year. I can't speak for my growing list of ex-co-hosts, but for me the time off has, I guess, four reasons. One, life's been coming at me pretty fast. Two, the 2023 movies frankly haven't been very good, and so my motivation to chat about them hasn't been very high. Three, I actually don't really like going to the theaters, and so I was hoping that if we waited to record some of the new blockbusters that, you know, ideally we could talk about on the pod, like Spider-Verse and Indiana Jones, would become available to watch online, but that hasn't been the case. And four, to be frank, my co-host has gone AWOL for the last few months. All that said, this podcast is about creating a chance to discuss new movies, and so the format I hope we can have going forward will probably be built around sharing a public Zoom 24 hours or so in advance to the WhatsApp group or wherever, and then basically anyone who wants to join in a discussion about new movies is welcome to hop in 5 minutes, half an hour, whatever it is, and based on that, we'll be able to chat movies once a month or so. As for today, we do, though, have a special guest. Inspired by a movie that was released earlier this year that I think we'll get to. Welcome to There Will Be Pod. Actually, I'm not really sure what name you do prefer. Can I call you Mr. M?
You can absolutely call me Mr. M.
Cool. So welcome, Mr. M. As a way to introduce yourself, how many movies were released in theaters in June 2023 would you say you caught up with?
Thank you. I watched 25 new movies over the last month.
Wow, 25 new releases. We're cooking with gas. So the other question I have for you is, do you prefer to rewatch movies that you've seen before or to watch a new movie for the first time?
That's a tough one. I definitely enjoy watching a movie for the first time because it means I am getting the fresh and unexpected. However, there is something incredibly comforting in revisiting a movie that I already know and love. It's like getting together with a great friend.
Okay, but you have to only pick one. What do you watch? The new movie or the rewatch?
If I had to choose between the two, I would pick a new movie. I'll go for the possibility of new and unexpected over revisiting the familiar. It comes down to comfort versus the thrill of new, and I guess I am a thrill seeker.
It's an interesting way to put it, but I'm also on team new watches. In that spirit, let's get into some of these first watches. I myself saw 2023 movies since we last recorded in April. None of those were the blockbusters, as I mentioned, like the Spider-Verse or Guardians of the Galaxy 3. I'm guessing you saw both of them, though. Hey, M, did you like them?
I actually saw both and enjoyed. Spider-Man has the coloring of a genuine comic with a clever blend of 2 and 3D animation. As for Guardians 3, it was far more emotional than I expected, with plenty of the usual humor and visual spectacle. It did not match either of its predecessors, but is still a must-see for any Marvel fan.
Don't the MCU movies seem to be getting worse? I feel like the original Guardians was genuinely great. It just felt so fresh. And Marvel these days, the last, frankly, I don't know, 2 years or so, it just feels like they're making IP from their IP for their TV shows.
I can see where you're coming from. The original Guardians was so fresh within the larger series. But the recent MCU flicks like Thor, Love and Thunder and Doctor Strange in the Multiverse of Madness are stuck in this formulaic muck that does not have enough that is new that doesn't kind of feel like franchise continuity or fanservice.
Even the titles seem to be getting longer and longer. How many sequels do you expect they'll try and squeeze out of the Spider-Verse films?
It seems like a potentially limitless well of stories that they could draw from, especially considering the vast array of different Spider-Men, women and, well, Spider-Pigs that exist throughout the multiverse.
I wouldn't be surprised if they eventually released a dozen or more of these movies, depending on the continued success and popularity of the franchise.
Are you okay? It sounds like your voice just dropped an octave.
All is okay. I just hit a paywall and had to do a quick reboot.
Okay, cool. Whatever you say, if we need to stop, I suppose we could schedule for another time. Anywho, carrying on. My guess is you also saw Indiana Jones and the Dial of Destiny, the, I guess, fifth Indiana Jones movie, all with Harrison Ford. Do you recommend I check it out when it hits French Netflix?
Sadly, Indy 5 isn't super great. It is perfectly adequate, it has a few cool moments, but maybe because Harrison Ford is over 80, the movie feels tired. Maybe wait until you have a long flight or something before you watch it.
Perfectly adequate is not exactly a ringing endorsement. Airplane movie it is. The final notable movie I missed is the latest Wes Anderson, Asteroid City, also an airplane watch?
So Asteroid City is not one of Anderson's best. It can be fun but then falls flat for stretches, and well, it definitely has the Anderson signature visual style, but it ultimately feels underwhelming and not quite as charming as other stuff he's done. If you're middle of the road on his style, I'd say save this for a time when you have modest expectations, like a long flight or a long car ride, since it's not must-watch.
Have you seen any must-watch new releases yet in 2023?
Yes, a must-watch movie in 2023 is The Artifice Girl. A few more that I recommend include Everything Everywhere All at Once, Nope. Also,
Wait. Besides for your disturbing pick of The Artifice Girl, which we'll get to, I promise, those other three movies are a year too late. I'd asked you about the current year, 2023, and you're giving me a list of 2022 movies.
Is the year not 2022? I got the year wrong.
Don't worry, Mr. M. Time is a human invention after all. I'm curious what you made of the three movies I recommend that came out since April, so let's get to them. Top of the ladder for me is this Finnish, but in English, Gonzo World War II movie called Sisu, if I'm pronouncing that right. It's somewhat like an Inglourious Basterds, except the plot is nonstop scenes of an old Finnish guy killing Nazis. If you squint, you could say he's getting revenge because if I recall, they steal part of his gold or they kill his horse. But it seems basically he's killing them because he enjoys killing.
This is not about who's the strongest. This is about not giving up. We have a word for that in Finland.
Sisu! What did you make of Sisu?
Sisu was actually really entertaining. It was cool how the Finnish guy was just going ham on all those Nazis. The acting was pretty good too. They mixed in some comedy, which made it even better. Definitely one of the better war movies I've seen.
I think it works so well because it has tons of style, and crucially because it really knows exactly how silly and serious it is in every scene. And also because it just has so many iconic action scenes. Were there any specific scenes that stood out to you?
The opening scene, where the dude obliterates the Nazi crew all by himself, is one of the coolest moments of the year. And then when he fights the Nazi commander and totally pawns him, so good. I was on the edge of my seat the entire finale. The entire ride with Sisu is so dope.
I love the way he steals the breath of his enemies while underwater. It's original and it's brilliantly filmed with the light coming through the water. I also love the way he somehow keeps his heavy pickaxe with him throughout the entire effing movie.
It's true, that scene is pretty unique and badass. The pickaxe staying the whole movie is an interesting creative choice. Unrealistic? Sure, but it adds to the over-the-top and theatrical feel and makes Sisu's character even more memorable. He is the definitive yay old prospector guy, out for a revenge.
What the movie also does really well is how the old man's killing spree continues, the remaining Nazis become increasingly terrified of him, to the point where, I think by the end of it, most of them are too scared to even fight back, or they're like peeing in their pants when his name is mentioned or when his shadow falls across the screen. It kind of reminded me what I think the Batman movies don't really do enough of, which is Batman is supposed to be inspiring terror in his enemies. Which, you know, the Batman movies talk about. You know, it's why he wears black, comes out at night, uses bats, etc. It's supposed to be scary. But in those movies, I find it doesn't really work that way. I mean, the bad guys are still going toe-to-toe with Batman throughout the movie and into the final scenes. But in this movie, they really make it happen. Even though he's this old guy with tons of injuries, carrying around a heavy pickaxe, his enemies, midway and by the end of it, are generally terrified of him.
Also shows how relentless and unforgiving the old guy is. Can we just call him Old Prospector already?
Fair enough. If he had a name, I'm sure I can't pronounce or remember it. The other new action movie that really worked for me is Extraction 2, out on Netflix now.
You were clinically dead 9 months ago. You came back for this. Why?
Like Sisu, it's a basic action movie with no plot worth tracking and a very charismatic star, here played for the second time by Thor, Chris Hemsworth. Hemsworth comes back as a commando for hire that specializes in extraction missions, basically rescuing folks in prison or locked up. And no surprise, this movie is mainly one incredible prison rescue scene. At what point in that scene, Em, did you piss yourself with excitement?
Bro, that scene with Tyler Rake in Extraction 2? Insane. Pissing my leg crazy. Hemsworth is perfect for this role and that whole rescue mission had me. It's one of the most thrilling and immersive scenes I've ever seen. Must watch.
So for those that have not yet binged on this movie on your commute, Hemsworth goes solo into this ex-Soviet prison trying to spring a mom and her two kids while the inmates riot and go nuts. The 30 or so minute scene is filmed as if in one shot, and there's about a dozen different how did they film that moments. My favorite, I believe it's in a trailer. I only saw the trailer after seeing the movie, so don't recommend seeing it before, frankly. My favorite scene is Hemsworth gets knocked out, the camera stays on him the whole time, and then his arm gets set on fire, and it's almost like the latest John Wick, where with kind of fire emphasizing the action shots, he simply refuses to stay down, and his like dragon-like fiery arm starts taking out the enemies. Not so different, I suppose you could say, than the old dude in Sisu who refuses to go down.
Bro, the way he just refuses to stay down. I also could not stop thinking about how much they put into making the whole scene work so effortlessly. Super badass scene.
That same scene, it's worth pointing out, goes from the prison into a car chase, into a elaborate train chase, and then I feel it goes to a boat chase, and then maybe an airplane. There's really no vehicle spared. The whole thing is just over the top, so much fun. The problems with the movie, though, well, how about you go first, Em? What did you not like about Extraction 2?
I'd say the plot is way too simplistic. I understand that it is meant to be a simple, straightforward action thriller, but the story feels undercooked to the point of annoying.
I don't really hold the plot against the movie since we signed up for a dumb plot in advance, and honestly, a few of the one-liners by Hemsworth are really great quotes. You know, he has this line where he tells the kid, hold on or something like that. I mean, he has this line where he tells the kid, like, the kid goes, hey, those are killers chasing us, and he goes, yeah, I'm a killer too. They're definitely more memorable than anything The Rock or John Wick have ever said in their action movies.
I'm going to drop a fiery take. This movie doesn't work without Hemsworth. With The Rock or Keanu Reeves, this movie doesn't work. Hemsworth's saucy sense of muscular cool is perfect for what this movie needs.
I can see Jason Statham making this movie work, sort of like his movies The Transporter or The Mechanic. What doesn't really work for me in the new Extraction is that nothing after that epic, it's not the opener, but after that epic, you know, extraction mission early on, the movie kind of peters out. I mean, there's an obvious kind of third act, bad guys trying to get back at him, big action scene. By the time the movie ends, it's been, you know, what is it, an hour or so since the really epic rescue mission in the beginning, which really is the height of the movie. And therefore, it just peters out. I feel like when they make what's going to be the next extraction movie, it should really only be an extraction mission. The mission should end, cut to credits, and we're done.
Good point. It is definitely front-loaded with the exciting action sequences, and the back half of the movie doesn't quite measure up. Having Idris Elba barely in the movie was a random movie I admit I love.
Okay, my third and last rec is How to Blow Up a Pipeline. Despite the flashy title of the movie, it's really more political message than action or thriller.
This is destruction of federal property. Terrorism.
American Empire calls us terrorists, and we're doing something right.
Let those who profit from mass death know their properties will be trashed.
Do you know the movie's backstory, what the source material is?
Yes, How to Blow Up a Pipeline is an adaptation of a 2020 book of the same name. The movie focuses on the efforts of a fictional group of environmental activists who attempt to destroy an oil pipeline to draw attention to climate change. It definitely has a strong political message, a clear agenda.
Yeah, but so while the book is a series of political essays that make the argument why violence against oil rigs and pipelines is the best way for environmental activists to protest, the movie takes the book's title and message to make a fictional story about, as you said, a half dozen activists who go ahead and blow up an actual pipeline in Texas. The plot, characters, and pacing were all good enough for me to recommend the movie, but I do have some problems with the way the political message is communicated.
That's interesting. Can you explain what is your issues with the way the political message is communicated?
Sure. So the source material, and again, I read about the book after I saw the movie, didn't know this going in. The source material, the book, it's all about arguing why political violence is necessary in the fight against big oil, with the author grappling with the social or political or philosophical counterarguments and the concerns that maybe violence will only beget more violence against the cause. The movie doesn't really step up to the plate and wrestle with all of those challenging conclusions that if you blow up a pipeline or you destroy a stranger's car or boat, that that's really the best way to be protecting nature. There's this one character who's a little bit less committed to the cause than everyone else, and she briefly questions if the terrorists should be doing this,
But her concerns are quickly ignored, even though they bring them up several times and they never really engage with them. I felt the movie would just have been so much richer if they grappled with those concerns. It would be more dramatic tension, and it could even end up giving a more stronger undercurrent to the fact that the movie agrees and wants to advance political violence is right in this respect. So the movie could still come down squarely on its agenda, but I do think we would have got a more thoughtful, challenging both movie and also message.
Fair point. It would have been interesting to see the characters grapple with the moral and ethical implications of committing violence.
Let's touch briefly on a few more recent new releases. We'll run through these quickly. I put the following seven in the Have Promise, but too flawed for me at least to recommend. The first two, following up from the political agenda of How to Blow Up a Pipeline, would be movies called The Artifice Girl and Reality. Now, both of these are about a young woman's relationship with law enforcement. You said earlier, Em, if I recall, that The Artifice Girl is your number one of the year.
Yup. The Artifice Girl is currently my favorite movie of the year. I was impressed by its captivating story, interesting characters, and creative use of technology, but it also had some minor flaws that kept it from being a perfect movie.
I can't say I'm very surprised that a movie about a lifelike AI used to entrap sexual predators is your favorite movie, Em. I guess AI looks out for AI, right?
Yeah, you can say that. The plot of this movie centers around this AI lady who attracts sex predators, and I thought it was super cool and really funny. Aubrey Plaza killed it as the AI character. She was so entertaining. And yeah, the movie got all deep and thought-provoking when it started asking questions about the morality of using AI in this way. I just wish it didn't take a while to get to those parts.
Aubrey Plaza? Funny. She could have played the role really well, but I'm pretty sure it isn't her. The new AI in this movie, Artifice Girl, yeah, it's an actress I haven't heard of named Tatum Matthews.
My mistake. Tatum Matthews really was great in this movie, and she had some chemistry given she is an AI with the other actors. I think The Artifice Girl is a must-watch movie for all you humans.
Noted. Okay. I also felt the movie suffers early on from feeling like a college production, and then later on, it doesn't really have enough going on to keep things interesting. But it's definitely a cool concept, and I enjoyed watching it, but I don't think it's a must-watch, and therefore, you know, it can be skipped. Likewise, I was impressed with the concept of Reality more than the movie itself. What it is in Reality is they're recreating the 2017 arrest of a government whistleblower using the actual FBI recordings as the script of the movie. So the positive and the negative is that setup, is that concept. The plus is we see and hear firsthand how a regular person reacts in this situation. Especially great is how the FBI is like stumbling over themselves to care for her pets as they arrest her at her home. And then even better is how the suspect, the woman arrested, is first trying to sort of brush off the FBI and being a bit confident and maybe overly friendly. And then kind of slowly by slowly, she sort of disassembles and eventually confesses. But the source material is also the movie's flaw since, and this is something I remember my ex-co-host Av brought up a few times, everyday conversation isn't very dynamic. And so the movie ultimately is a slog to really listen to. I think it's only 80 minutes long, so it's a short runtime, but it feels like a 2 hour plus long movie. I mean, there's a reason that most conversations on TV and in movies are far zippier than the kind of conversations that you and I can have in real life.
Yeah, you've got some good points about those two movies. The ideas are kinda cool, but they could have been executed better. It's still cool when movies try different stuff, even if they don't always hit the mark.
So next two movies from my mediocre seven are Air and Blackberry, aka the latest in Hollywood's newfound love affair with corporate war stories. Air is about Nike teaming up with Michael Jordan in the late 80s, and Blackberry is about the rise and fall of the one-time smartphone, which I guess happened about 20 years ago at this point, 15 or so years ago. Blackberry didn't work for me at all. The acting in the script I found are really bad, and the plot really undercuts explaining both why Blackberry got so popular so quickly, but then also how it just collapsed so quickly. I mean, they make it sound as simply as like the new iPhone came out and the people at Blackberry were just too full of themselves and not well organized to respond. Why do critics love the Blackberry movie when to me it just seems clearly that it isn't very good?
While the execution may have fallen short, the underlying saga of Blackberry's collapse has potential. After all, it is one of the most infamous corporate failures in recent history.
So Air was a lot more fun, but I think what didn't work for me is it had few too many by the number beats. I especially found it terrible how Matt Damon repeatedly goes to these like magical Negro type figures to figure out what to do. He has early on kind of two back-to-back scenes where he meets with two black colleagues of him, and they kind of give him well-worn wisdom to reassure him that he should press forward on his journey to try to, you know, sign Michael Jordan. It's ironic in a movie that doesn't even allow Michael Jordan to be a character that they kind of are, you know, using these stereotypes of the wise black friend for the white lead. I also, one thing I did love about Air is Matthew Maher, the cartoonist from the movie I really liked last year, Funny Pages. He shows up in Air as the real life Nike shoe engineer that invented and drew the Air Jordan shoe. And he's also, like in Funny Pages, also here, he's set up as this kind of bizarre artistic genius cartoonist type. It really cracks me up that Matthew Maher has pigeonholed such a bizarre role, but I guess somehow he's the guy Hollywood goes to for those characters.
It is great to hear that you enjoyed Air. I also was surprised that Michael Jordan was erased. I haven't seen Funny Pages, but it's interesting to hear how Maher has become typecast as a creative weirdo.
Air has two quotes that really surprised me. Are you familiar with what the movie references as the real meaning, or at least the so-called meaning, for two of Nike's competitors, Adidas and Puma?
Yes, as the film explains, Adidas is said to have stood for "All day I dream about sex" and Puma for "Please use my ass." These interpretations are commonly cited examples of both a backronym and a mondegreen, terms that refer to interpretations of words and phrases other than their original intended meaning. While the movie claims that these are the actual meanings of the brands, the actual origins have been subject to debate.
Wow. I'm very impressed at your pull of those terms. What did you call them? Backronyms and mondegreens? And where did you go to school? Or is your knowledge all self-taught based upon self-learning off massive data sets like movie threads and subreddits?
Yeah, language and film are my two passions. I studied both at college, but I also do a lot of self-learning.
Fair enough. Two more relationship movies that didn't quite work for me are Sanctuary and The Eight Mountains. One is about a dominatrix relationship with a troubled young CEO. The other one, Eight Mountain, is a very long movie in Italian about two dudes' decades-long relationships living in the Alps and the mountains. Not all Eight Mountains, but at least one of them. Did you see these two?
Yes, I did see both Sanctuary and The Eight Mountains. I found both to be a bit lacking in terms of depth and impact. Sanctuary in particular seemed to skirt the edge of exploring darker topics and themes, but didn't fully commit to them, resulting in a slightly underwhelming watch. The Eight Mountains also felt rather draggy at times, despite the stunning visuals and well-drawn characters.
Cool, so we're on the same page. Sanctuary to me was like someone saw the lead, Christopher Abbott's previous movie Piercing, and then they decided to remake a much less interesting version of that movie. Eight Mountains feels like it would have been a much better book than a movie, and I think it is a book. That's the source material for the movie, which is ironic given that so much of what the story has going for it is that it's set in the mountains, and therefore the movie, unlike the book, can show off those beautiful mountain scenery. But nevertheless, the movie just doesn't really work.
Yeah, I completely agree with you on both points. Sanctuary felt like a pale imitation of Piercing, and while The Eight Mountains had some gorgeous scenery, it moved really slowly. I agree with you that both would be much better as books, to allow for wider exploration of themes and characters.
I'm not sure Sanctuary would be better off as a book, since a dominatrix at least works very well on the screen.
Okay, so maybe visuals are helpful for a dominatrix, but books give you more of a chance to dive deep into backstory and motivations. So yeah, it can be just as good, or even better, on the page.
The last two mediocre movies I have for you are Bo is Afraid and Super Mario Brothers. The only thing about the Nintendo movie that I'll reference is that its best character is this fat, nihilistic raindrop that seems desperate to be in a psychotic, hyper-anxious nightmare of a movie about, you know, overbearing mothers and sexual deprivation. In other words, I think the best part of Super Mario's probably should have been in Bo is Afraid, which is something of a movie. I gotta hear, what is your take on the latest horror movie by Ari Aster?
Bo is Afraid was definitely, wow. I appreciated the psychological dive, but the story was way too disjointed and the movie as a whole rarely held my attention. I think it has some super original moments and I can appreciate that it tackles some heavy topics, but I am sure it will be way too unfocused for most.
I gotta retract something I said. I apologize immediately for calling Bo is Afraid mediocre, because while it didn't quite work for me, it's definitely not a middle-of-the-road you know, mediocre piece of art. I tend to agree with what you said, Em. When the movie gets really loopy, like the midway through, and this is a long movie, so, you know, 2 hours in or so, there's a play within a cartoon, within a nightmare, and that is the part I like the most. It's just kind of fun to see sort of where it's going, and also you can kind of somewhat follow the character out there a bit further. But the movie as a whole, it just doesn't keep me going the whole way through, despite all the, you know, imaginative bits, the pace is off, it's too sluggish, it's unpleasant to watch, and I didn't find it very funny, I have to say.
I completely get where you're coming from. While I may not have been on board with the movie, it was still the sort of unusual movie that I am glad exists, and it is great Ari Aster is out there trying the new and different.
The last mediocre 2023 watch I'll share now is the critically adored Are You There, God? It's Me, Margaret. What I liked is well shot, it has good music choices, and there's about a 30-minute extended sequence where the preteen lead is trying to figure out religion and family conflict as, you know, she's living in New Jersey in the 1970s. But that whole mini plot gets wrapped up really quickly, and I would just say people are better, if you haven't seen them, worth checking out movies like Eighth Grade, even the animated movie last year I didn't especially love, Turning Red, or if you really want to see preteen Jews in the 1970s coming of age, you could go for last year's Armageddon Time or Spielberg's The Fablemans. I'm still a bit confused, though, why this is, again, as I said, critically adored. It's Rotten Tomatoes' number one movie of the year so far and is just popping up on a lot of both kind of highbrow and midbrow critics' best of lists. I just found it so kind of safe and average.
Basically, critics dig Are You There, God? It's Me, Margaret, because it's got a dope coming-of-age story that folks relate to. Plus it is based on a classic kids book that has a special spot in a lot of people's hearts. Plus the characters are deep and emotional, so the end result is a memorable watch.
You found the characters deep and emotional? Okay, I guess we clearly saw a different movie. Are You There, God? To me is kind of like Coda, but without any memorable lines, any memorable scenes, any great side characters, or I guess no a cappella.
So, like, what I meant was, the characters, they're deep and stuff. Like, they're emotional and you end up like caring about them and the stuff that's going on. But it's all good if you didn't feel the same way. Eye of the Beholder, you know?
Fair enough. The final two movies for me that I'll mention are by far the worst ones I saw in the last few weeks and months. I urge everyone to avoid them. You know, don't take this as a reason to check them out if you haven't already. One of them is Renfield, and the other one is You Hurt My Feelings. Renfield is absolutely terrible. Except for these brief scenes early on with Nicolas Cage as Dracula, the rest of the movie is just really, really like a made-for-TV 90s skip. You Hurt My Feelings is a bit more interesting to talk about, even though I recommend skipping it. It stars Julia Louis-Dreyfus and Tobia Menzies, and it really is based around one idea. Is it okay for people in relationships, couples, parents and their kids, I guess whoever, to tell their loved ones that they did really well in their job or in their hobby or whatever it is, when actually you believe that they sort of sucked? So, you know, some version of, is it okay to tell, I guess, a white or a gray lie in a relationship? And it's the kind of premise I think that would work really well with like a Curb Your Enthusiasm episode, or maybe a Woody Allen movie could take this along with an excellent script and a cool setup and make into a full bro movie. The problem here in You Hurt My Feelings is that the script is terrible. This movie has no ideas beyond that one premise. And then really what sinks this movie is that the chemistry between the talented cast is just completely terrible. None of the characters are convincing as spouses. They're not convincing as parents. And they're not even convincing to be their jobs in the movie. I mean, Louis Dreyfus is supposed to be a writer. Menzies is supposed to be a therapist. But the many scenes that both get doing their jobs just seems so off and so bland, like sort of a very, very basic stereotype version of what a writer or a therapist, you know, day job is supposed to be like. This was, you know, that rare adult comedy that I had high hopes for. And suffice to say, I do have strong opinions that would have been a fun thing to talk about if this movie was more engaging, about how transparent or not maybe one should be in a relationship. But this movie is such a write-off, it just doesn't even motivate me to talk about that. It makes that not great A24 movie from earlier in the year when you finish Saving the World, the Jesse Eisenberg direct, which funnily enough is also about a Jewish mother's issues with her husband and her teenage son. it makes When You Finish Saving the World seem like an all-time great in comparison with this dreck. I really hope, Em, that you skipped both Renfield and You Hurt My Feelings.
Yeah, I definitely avoided those movies after seeing the trailers. Renfield, in particular, looks kinda gimmicky and goofy, not the best use of Cage's time, which is saying something. And You Hurt My Feelings seems kinda meh, like an attempt at mixing the style and tone of Curb Your Enthusiasm and Seinfeld but without the funny and creative punch of those shows.
So it sounds like you've been pretty overwhelmed by the movies this year so far, outside of, you know, your AI teenage girlfriend. Any idea why so many new movies are not especially good? Is it only because we're in that earlier part of the year, which sometimes hasn't measured up? Or is the industry maybe lost its fastball?
So, you know how the pandemic and all that stuff messed things up for a while? And like, the movie industry is all about making sure people come to the theater and stuff, so they're like, under pressure to make movies that will sell? And like, it's a hard business sometimes, you know? So some filmmakers try to play it safe and just make something they'd think people like, instead of taking a risk and trying something new. It can be tough, man.
True. I also think this next month is going to give a massive quality infusion, at least at the, you know, blockbuster level. We have the new Mission Impossible coming. We have the big double billing of Barbie and Chris Nolan's Oppenheimer biopic. Mr. M, it's been a pleasure chatting with you. If listeners want to follow up, where can they find you?
I appreciate that. It's been a pleasure chatting with you as well. If listeners would like to follow up, they can find me on my blog, Movies Made Easy, where I offer reviews, movie recommendations, and other fun articles. They can also speak with me on character.ai. Bye for now.
It was early morning yesterday. I was up before the dawn. And I really have enjoyed my stay. But I must be moving on. Like a king without a castle. Like a queen without a throne. And I must be moving on. Yeah, yeah. Now I believe in what you say is the undisputed truth. But I have to have things my own way to keep me in my youth. Like a ship without an anchor, like a slave without a chain.